Veit Rausch did not like the numbers. He had been assigned three of them at his shack near the bottom of the lonely mountainside road that led up to the Four Village. The only route by land into the village, theirs was the first line of defense against intruders. It should therefore have been the most heavily manned area within the Four perimeter. Instead, there were only the four of them. While Veit sat on his stool in the small shed, the three numbers stood at attention along the road. That's what they were called around the village, numbers. They didn't have names. They had assigned digits. They were the blonde-haired, blue-eyed creations of the late Dr. Erich von Breslau and his team of neo-Nazi geneticists. The eggs of a violently unwilling host had been harvested by von Breslau. The woman, of course, had been sacrificed to a greater cause. Through some genetic tinkering that Rausch could not begin to understand, a strand of perfect Aryan DNA had been produced in a laboratory. It combined the flawless traits of a dozen male volunteers. This genetic information was injected into the many egg cells, and the whole melange was introduced into the bodies of local peasant women whose families had been well compensated for their nine-month inconvenience. The result was the numbers, hundreds of identical soldiers programmed to blindly serve the leaders of four. It was discovered after the birth of the first infants that there had been some unseen flaw in the DNA cocktail. Von Breslau's monsters were born incapable of speech. Not long after this failed experiment, Adolf Kluge had assumed his post as head of four. The genetics lab was closed down and its research was halted. Proof of four's sorry flirtation with manufactured perfection, the numbers were kept alive as workhorses. Rausch looked at the three men lined up along the road. He found them particularly unnerving in those instances when they happened to blink in unison. They could not even rightly be termed freaks of nature, Rausch realized, for nature had little to do with their creation. They stood, each one interchangeable with the next, as monuments to failure. Rausch vowed that if there was any trouble, they would bear the brunt of it. Rausch frowned as he considered the events of the past few months. It was disgusting that four had come to this. Rausch was the grandson of an important Gestapo officer. The Four Village had always been an unassailable bastion against the perverted thinking of the modern world. It had never seen any kind of trouble since his grandfather's day. But there had been so many deaths in recent months. Some of the dead were people Rausch knew. Four was at the center of an ever-tightening noose. And in the darkest corners of Rausch's mind, he wondered if any of them could survive. Rausch calmed himself, then glanced at the numbers. They hadn't seen his display of nerves. Not that it mattered. The brutish mutes would not have been able to tell anyone even if they had.
Rausch.
There has been an incident in Uruguay.
Yes?
One of our contacts was found dead.
Oman? Is it them?
Not likely. Groth was shot to death, and the men we expect do not use weapons. Still, he is a direct link to us. Remain alert.
Rausch hopped off his stool and stepped towards the road. The lush green scenery that stretched out around them was a painted canvas remarkable only in the diversity of tone. There were greens in these low hills, unseen anywhere else in nature. The mountains loomed high to his right. There were only two types of peaks from Rausch's vantage point, tall and taller. To his left, down a short incline, the mountain road snaked a sharp U-turn, disappearing into the forest. Beyond the visible stretch of road was a wide open field, and beyond that, still more mountains. Though it was a breathtaking vista, Rausch barely saw it. He was fingering his swastika collar pin as he stepped over to the three numbers.
Stay alert!
It was unnecessary to repeat the command. The men did not even turn his way. They continued staring intently down to the point where the road cut sharply down around an island of foliage. Rausch turned around and began to head back to the shack. Rausch paused. He glanced down the incline to the lower half of the road just as the jeep broke into view. As it approached on the lower level, Rausch could see only the driver. There were no passengers. When the jeep passed on the road beneath, Rausch could clearly make out the face behind the wheel. It was a woman, and there was something about her features that seemed strangely familiar. The car disappeared behind the stabbing strip of trees and overgrown shrubs. Back near the shack, the numbers were already aiming their guns down the road, ready to shoot the incoming car the instant it broke cover. The jeep, however, remained hidden behind the copse of trees.
What is she doing?
Maybe she had to make a pit stop.
Roush wheeled around. Primo was leaning against the guard shack, a placid smile decorating his hard features.
There is no need to be vulgar.
The master of Shenanju stood next to Remo, dressed in an orange kimono with red piping. Roush leapt aside and in his panic, fell out of the shack and down an incline. As soon as Roush had dived out of the way, three pale fingers tensed on triggers. Remo and Chun danced around the incoming ledge.
Wait a minute! Those are the same three guys from the airport! Something screwy here!
Yes. While you chatter on like a stupid monkey, we are being shot at.
That's news?
The masters of Shenanju raced across the road to the three men, dodging their blasts. Chun was first into the group of men. The old Korean danced in between the two nearest numbers. Chun had pulled two heads hard together by two handfuls of blonde hair. Perfect Aryan brains dripped down from perfect Aryan ears and nostrils in perfect little driblets. Remo flew to the third and final triplet. The last man was spinning in place, desperate to locate his suddenly missing targets. His blue eyes had only just alighted on the smears of gray puree on the road and the placid kimono-clad figure standing above them when he felt a tap on his shoulder.
Checkout time, Goldilocks.
The surviving number saw a thick-wristed hand flutter up before his face, index finger and pinky extended. Briefly, in the uncomplicated center of his genetically engineered brain, the last number wondered what this man was doing, and then his survival instinct kicked in. Unfortunately, in that infinitesimally short period of time during which he was raising his gun, Remo's hand was already shooting forward. The blonde man had felt an unbelievable blinding pressure at his eyes. Twin supernovas had exploded, each bearing the distinctive swirl patterns of Remo's fingerprints. And then the entire universe had collapsed back into ethereal nothingness. There were no eyes visible in the blood-lined sockets, yet not a trace of ocular fluid or gore was visible on Remo's hand. It was as if the eyes had simply evaporated. Remo turned from the body.
I better go get the other one.
Exchanging tight glances, both masters of Shenanju raced over to the hill that looked down onto the lower half of the road. Bite Roush's twisted body lay on the ground. Above him, gun in hand, stood Heidi Stolp. When Remo and Chun broke into view on the hill, Heidi twisted and crouched, aiming her gun up at them with cool professionalism. When she saw who was looking down at her, she relaxed.
Is it safe?
That depends on who you plan to shoot next.
Heidi took this as a yes. She ran back up the road, disappearing behind the cluster of trees. Remo and Chun climbed into the vehicle.
You must be putting your ammo dealer's kids through college.
Does he always feel compelled to talk, even when it is not necessary, Chun?
I spend half my time shushing him and the other half explaining the punchlines to jokes. He is not a bad son, mind you, just dour and a chatterbox. And he sometimes chews with his mouth open.
Look, can we just get going?
He's your son.
That's it. I'm walking.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Heidi turned back to the wheel. She seemed upset with herself for becoming distracted. But even as she eased around the bodies of the failed neo-Nazi experiment for perfection, her eyes strayed to the rearview mirror and the wizened figure in the back seat. There was something infinitely sad in the depths of her azure eyes. Adolf Kluge watched the Jeep proceed on one of the many video monitors that lined the curving wall in the special rear room of the ancient temple. The treetop surveillance camera tracked the vehicle as far as it could before the system automatically switched over to the next camera. The surveillance had been arranged so that once a vehicle entered the protected four perimeter, it was never out of sight. The Jeep was moving fast. This was it, Kluge thought. This was how four would end. He still couldn't completely believe that it would happen. Even though he had seen what these men could do, it was impossible to conceive that these two unexceptional appearing men would overwhelm four's defenses. And yet, Kluge would not have evacuated the village if he truly believed the village could survive otherwise. Many of the monitors displayed the empty homes of the abandoned village. In streets and near the mouth of the fortress, his army of men waited patiently. Kluge spun his chair around. Hermann sat over near the radio equipment.
Tell them they are almost here.
Yes, Herr Cluj. They have entered our perimeter. Stand ready.
Cluj turned his attention back to the intruders.
Let us see if we cannot stop them before they get here.
Once Cluj finished flipping the toggle switches, his hand strayed to a single button, index finger hovering in place. Eyes alert, Adolf Cluj watched the progress of the Jeep.
Stop the Jeep!
Why?
Stop!
The mountain stretched up on their left. A wooded slope dropped off to their right, overshadowed by a nearby hill.
You feel them, little father?
Of course. There are many of them.
Too many to go through?
For us? No.
Remo looked at Heidi. From the way they spoke, she felt as if she was holding them back somehow. Her expression made it clear she didn't enjoy being treated as a handicap.
What is it?
Wait here.
Standing on the road, he felt around under his seat. Remo held out a tire iron for Heidi's inspection.
So?
Watch.
Remo flipped the tire iron up the road. It soared 24 yards before it finally began to fall. A huge flash of white and orange had belched from the earth.
Landmines!
The exploding kind. Looks like we'll have to hoof it after all.
It is a lovely day for a walk.
How do we get through without setting them off? How do we get through without setting them off?
Damn! How did they know?
Cluj's hand withdrew from the minefield's remote arming system.
They could not possibly. We planted them only this morning.
Say no, Hermann. Does this woman with them look like anyone to you?
Possibly the numbers.
Of course. A perfect Aryan woman, siding with our attackers. A fitting irony for those who write the final history of four.
He watched the three of them abandon the Jeep and head away from the minefield. They went down the side of the hill, disappearing from the camera's range. Cluj felt a tingle of excitement.
Perhaps there's still hope.
Cluj leaned over the board before him. With desperate hands, he had remotely armed every mine in the road. When he was finished, he waited at the master control.
How long ago did they go down?
20 seconds, perhaps 30.
They move quickly, but she will slow them up. Half a minute to the bottom, plus another minute to get into position?
Cluj was counting in his head. When he had guessed a minute and a half had elapsed, he held his finger over the single button that would detonate the entire field of mines.
We will see if we can't surprise the men from Shinanju after all.
The tree-dotted hill sloped down sharply to a narrow strip of level land. This mini-gorge, which ran parallel to both the road on one side and to the upward slope of the adjacent hill on the other, was packed with pine needles and rotting leaves. Some of the boulders that had been displaced when the road was constructed had been rolled down into the ravine. There were many of these scattered like blocks after a child's tantrum. They stood in the way of Remo, Chun, and Heidi. Remo assumed he would have to help Heidi through the rough terrain, but he was pleasantly surprised to find she was much more agile than he expected. After abandoning the Jeep, she had pulled a drab green coat on over her t-shirt, dragging her omnipresent knapsack over too. With her thumbs tucked into the backpack's shoulder straps, she had scaled the rocks like a professional mountaineer. For their part, Remo and Chun had appeared to float effortlessly up one side of a rock before gliding back down to the ground. Chun had made the move look particularly graceful. The hem of his kimono billowed like a gaily colored parachute as the material caught the small air pockets in the cramped valley.
Are there any mines down here?
Remo's hands were stuffed in his pockets as he hopped down from a large boulder.
Hard to tell.
Heidi, who had until now been in the lead, stopped abruptly. Remo stopped as well.
Don't you know?
It's a little trickier here, given the terrain. Oddly enough, mines are much easier to detect in a car. I find that tires focus your senses.
It is their hollowness.
You think that's it?
The compressed air within reacts to the surface of the road. The normal sensory range is thus extended greatly.
That's probably true. I never thought much of it.
Fortunately for all of our sakes, you are not paid to think.
The master of Shinanju passed his two companions, disappearing over the far side of a high rock.
Is he always so unpleasant?
Nah, he's just showing off because he likes you. Let me give you a hand.
The rock Chun had vanished over was the tallest so far. Remo was pleased to find that Heidi was not too proud to accept help when it was offered. Remo held his hands out in an interlocking cup-like formation. Heidi placed one boot inside the U-shape and allowed Remo to boost her up to the rock. Remo hopped up beside her. They each walked to the other side of the great flat rock. belches of flame had been visible between the trunks and branches of trees as a black mushroom cloud had poured into the crisp mountain air. Heidi covered her face.
The mines!
A few boulders ahead of them, the master of Shinanju stopped dead. He shot a concerned look back to Remo.
What the hell set him off?
Even Heidi had felt the rumble beneath her feet. On the hill above them, she could see the tops of the farthest trees topple and vanish behind those closest to them. They were being flicked aside by some horrifying force. It was like a cliched movie scene in which some creature from a bygone age first makes its appearance, except this terror was real. It was an avalanche of boulders.
Remo!
Go!
Chun hesitated at first, too far away to offer assistance. All at once, he spun on a sandaled heel, his mouth a thin line. Rapidly, he began bounding from rock to rock, distancing himself from the main area of collapse. The trees nearest them ripped away. Like pencils in some massive sharpener, they had been flung beneath the great rolling boulders. The mighty trunks had been split to kindling and thrust into the ravenous maw of the avalanche. When the mass of rock was nearly upon them, Remo snatched Heidi up around the waist. It would be difficult enough by himself. He didn't know if he could manage with extra baggage. Remo didn't follow the master of Shinanju. He was too far back. If he attempted to follow, Remo would be swept under the collapsing mountain of debris. Instead, he spun on his heel, and Heidi in tow, headed directly into the incoming rush of stone and earth.
Hold on!
The first rock he encountered was only as large as a beach ball. Remo dropped one toe atop it. Using opposite force against the stone's forward momentum, Remo vaulted up and over. He landed on a larger, flatter stone that was being swept along at the fore of the advancing pile of churning rubble. Fortunately, Heidi was not fighting him. She remained limp beneath his arm, not wishing to distract him from his life or death ballet. His next jump had brought him to a toppled tree trunk. Remo ran to the far end of the log, then rode it like a surfboard back down into the growing pile of debris. Already in the valley, many of the rocks they had been climbing on earlier were covered by fresh stone. When the lower end of the log they were on had struck the swelling pile of debris, Remo jumped again. Both feet barely touched the surface of a dangerously splintering boulder before he sprang again. Remo leapfrogged again, but found the going increasingly easier. With a cloud of choking dust, the last of the largest chunks of earth and sections of broken road had rolled into the ravine. Remo set Heidi down. He glanced back at the damage. It looked as if the claw of a gigantic backhoe had swiped a huge chunk out of the side of the mountain. There was a single stripe of missing trees and rock running straight up to the road. The valley where they had been standing was buried. Heidi looked at Remo. For all his exertions, he had not broken a sweat. He wore a deep scowl.
Have I told you lately that I hate Nazis?
As he spoke, Chun bounded into view far ahead of them. He stood at the nearest visible part of the valley that had not been overrun by the avalanche. For an instant, when he first saw Remo, the master of Shinanju was visibly relieved.
Remo, that was adequate.
Adequate, my ass. That was perfect. And how the hell did they do that without us stepping on the damn things?
They could be set to accept a radio signal.
Thank you, Professor Science.
Do not ask if you do not wish to know.
Readjusting the pack on her back, she struck off toward Chun.
No wonder everyone loves Germans. They're so damned cuddly.
Following Heidi, he began hiking across the fresh pile of stone rubble toward the waiting master of Shinanju. It had been 45 minutes since Cluj had set off the field of landmines. The leader of four had sat in front of the bank of video monitors the entire time, his anxiety level rising every minute.
Has everyone reported in, Hermann?
Yes, sir.
Even Theodore? You were not able to raise him?
It was a communications problem. It has been corrected.
Cluj nodded. He glanced at the monitor on which he had last seen his stalkers. A ragged, V-shaped crater was visible on the road. Beyond it sat the girl's parked jeep.
They are dead, Herr Cluj.
Possibly.
I cannot imagine anyone surviving that.
In that case, I have the greater imagination. Still...
We could send the second unit down to sift the rubble.
Yes. Yes. All right.
Christoph, come in. Do you read me, Christoph?
Again, his radio message was greeted by silence.
More equipment failure.
Adolf Kluge switched his attention to the monitor screens. The second unit was the designation given to the four villager and his attendant group of numbers who were at the next checkpoint up from that of the late Veit Rausch, only a few yards outside the periphery of the village. When he called up the appropriate image on the nearest monitor, the tree-mounted camera panned the designated scene. Kluge's blood chilled to ice.
Never mind, Hermann.
Sir? Why?
Kluge pointed at the monitor above the second unit's small guard station. Hermann gaped at what appeared to be bodies lying around the road. When he looked closer, he saw a face that was clearly that of the man he had been trying to raise on the radio. The man's head was several feet away from his body.
How?
Heidi was stunned by how easily the two masters of Shinanju had taken out the dozen men stationed near the small shed. The four village sprouted out of the leveled mountaintop where the ruins of an ancient city had once stood. The priceless architecture of a culture long dead had been demolished for the comfort of the band of fugitive Nazis. Looming far above the village was Estomago del Diablo, the name given to the huge old temple that was the focal point of the entire area. The massive stone structure stared down protectively over the orderly little houses from its separate mountain peak.
Dollars to donuts, the head guy's in there.
Focused on the temple, they ran toward the first line of neat Bavarian-style houses.
Crappity crap crap crap!
A cluster of frantic four soldiers ran toward them down the street. The three of them quickly ducked down an alley. Remo quickly plucked Heidi from the path.
Stay in this house.
Remo and Chun whirled on the soldiers. The men ran into view at the mouth of the alley. Remo recognized their shared face immediately. He'd encountered the same face at the airport, as well as at the first two guard shacks.
Not him again.
Do not get distracted.
Chun leaped high to the left, Remo to the right. Hitting the eaves of the roofs with one foot, they pushed off and forward. They formed an invisible X as their paths nearly crossed in the air above the blazing gunfire. The heads of the baffled soldiers slipped below them as both masters of Shinanju flew over. Twisting in midair, they dropped down behind the startled four troops. Before the shock could even register, Remo and Chun launched themselves forward. A few guns had fired feeble bursts of lead into the clear blue sky as Chun had ripped through the men. Diet and exercise-hardened fingernails had clawed vicious strips through chest muscle and bone. Kneecaps had shattered, skulls had collapsed. Remo had torn into the crowd from the other side. He had spun like a top on one foot, barely seeming to change position. As he had swirled, an arm or foot had flown out of the twisting blur. In their wake, streaks of blood had erupted from corrupted throats and chests.
I'll get Heidi.
Remo raced back to the house where he had left her.
Heidi!
She was nowhere in sight. A quick search of the one-story structure found the house empty and the front door on the far side of the house ajar.
Double crap!
He ran back to meet Chun.
Heidi's gone.
We cannot search for her now.
She can't say I didn't warn her.
Together, they ran back out onto the tidy village road. Kluge had become more animated as he had watched the men from Shinanju slaughter his soldiers as easily as lesser mortals might step on an anthill. Four was still his home. He would do everything he could to preserve it.
Have them pull back to the field.
Is that wise?
Do it!
There was an angry spark in his eyes, a spark that had been absent ever since the dark days in Paris several months ago.
Pull back, Dieter!
Kluge watched Remo and Chun advance through the vacant streets of the village. Unseen by the masters of Shinanju, the defenders of Four began backing along streets closer to the temple. On Kluge's order, they were retreating to the large open field with its trampled vegetable and flower gardens. It seemed ridiculous. An entire army in retreat because of two unarmed men.
Is the other system operational?
Tested this morning.
I want it ready to switch over to manual if automated tracking fails.
At your command, dear Kluge.
Kluge saw that Hermann was sweating. He had been so calm during the whole time leading up to this crisis. The fool. Hermann had never thought there was a crisis. Kluge turned his attention back to the monitors. Remo and Chun continued their relentless advance. As he watched them move stealthily through the streets, his eyes strayed to a single red button on his control console, unlabeled. It was covered by a clear plastic lid.
There is something else here.
Now there's something you don't see every day.
Remo nodded to the army of identical soldiers arranged in the field before the ancient stone fortress. Although the men were lined up to fire, they didn't do so when Remo and Chun cleared the last of the quaint little gingerbread houses.
Not more mines.
He had been stomping his foot occasionally to get a crude sonic reading of the land up ahead. As far as he could tell, there were no landmines. The field was to their right. To their left, a stretch of rocky terrain dropped down after a few yards, only to come back into sight a little farther beyond. Continuing only briefly, it disappeared for good a short way farther on. Somewhere far below the last appearance of the rocky ridge was the road. The army continued to stand down as they approached.
Gee, do you think it's a trap?
Chun was peering at the uneven mound of stone to their left. Remo followed the elderly Korean's line of sight. He immediately saw the thick metal barrel jutting from the stone. Beyond this was another, then a third, fourth, and fifth. Each of the weird gun muzzles was aimed down the path and directly at Remo and Chun.
Oh, great.
They were controlled by human hands, so Remo hadn't felt the telltale sign of men about to shoot. Before he had properly prepared for an attack, the air was suddenly alive with burning lead fragments. More rounds screamed at him in that one instant than at any other single time in his life. His senses were strained to overloading as he flung himself to a protective outcropping of rock beside the road. The outcropping did not shelter him for long. As soon as he had hunkered down behind the great black stones, the blonde-haired four soldiers in the field across the road broke their ceasefire. He slid down behind the rocks, pushing himself low behind a small lip. Bullets were like angry hornets above his head. Remo was a sitting duck. He didn't know where Chun had gone to when the automated weapons had begun firing. Remo only hoped that the master of Shinanju was faring better than him. Chun had done much the same thing as Remo when the guns had begun their automatic firing. Unlike Remo, however, he had the fortune of landing in a crevice that was the sole blind spot of the nearest machine gun. As the men in the field opened fire on Remo, Chun quickly scampered around the far side of the large finger of rock behind which he had taken refuge. He came out close to the nearest gun. Though it tracked from side to side with relative ease, it had more difficulty moving up and down. Out on the road once more, Chun ducked below the barrage of lead. He skittered crab-like to the left, coming up between the first two weapons. They were altered versions of the GEC minigun. The pockmarked road was testament to the effectiveness of the weapon. Racing up alongside the automated gun, Chun ducked in behind. With two slaps from one long-nailed hand, Chun had broken the heavy guns loose from their moorings. The firing guns swept across the advancing mob of blonde-haired men. Crumpling bodies spit streaks of crimson across the lush green fields. There was no defense against the remorseless attack of the automated guns. Some tried to run. Most didn't have the time to even consider the option. In seconds, the grisly deed was done. As the bullet-riddled bodies fell, Chun scampered to the remaining three guns. By the time he had reduced the altered miniguns to pieces and returned to the road, the first two weapons had grown silent. The entire four army lay dead on the road. Not one man had survived the fierce gunfire. Across the road from the nearest dozen bodies, Remo came out from his protective outcropping of rock. He ran up to meet the master of Shinanju, his face growing more severe as he beheld the breadth of the carnage. He paused next to Chun, looking up at the ancient temple.
Let's finish this.
They turned to the huge stone fortress. The road ended at a long stone bridge, a remarkable piece of ancient construction spanning the two peaks of the four complex. Remo and Chun were nearly at the bridge when an odd expression crossed the face of the younger master of Shinanju.
Wait a sec.
What is it?
Didn't you feel that?
The carefully buried charges had torn huge slabs of the bridge away. The wide gap the crashing stone had left behind was too great for even a master of Shinanju to traverse. Adolf Kluge removed his finger from the single red button. He turned to Hermann.
We should go.
Hermann seemed shell-shocked. He nodded numbly to the four leader. Together, they left the monitor room for the bowels of the ancient temple. Remo had run back to the village in order to find something to bridge the gap left by the collapsed bridge. He returned after a few moments with a long extension ladder.
This should work. There.
Unmindful of the dizzying height, he and Chun raced across the aluminum ladder to the mouth of the temple. Remo was surprised when they encountered no resistance inside the huge, drafty fortress.
This Kluge is wise. Fearful for his life, a prince would ordinarily surround himself with guards. He realized that his greatest safety lay in sending his entire legion against us.
Fat lot of good it did him.
They found the abandoned monitor room.
I can smell their nervous sweat.
It is a pungent odor.
They went that way.
He and Chun ran through the cramped hallway and into a much larger chamber. The chamber had been the main sacrificial room for the priests of the ancient temple. A rock stairway led up the side of a huge pyramid-shaped stone structure in the center of the room, the sacrificial pit. Obviously, the previous occupants of the temple hadn't limited themselves to animal oblations. Cracked, brownish human skulls lined the ancient rock steps.
I love what they've done with this place.
Shh.
Remo cocked an ear. Exchanging glances, Remo and Chun flew side by side up the stairs to the sacrificial pit. They found what they had expected at the top. There was a deep black hole in which the dead victims of the temple priest had been dumped. Far below, much farther than the floor of the chamber itself, could be seen the reflective glow of dull yellow light. A steel ladder was attached to the interior stone wall of the pit. It was obviously a new addition since the Four occupation of the village. They climbed over the edge of the pit and slid down the 40 feet to the stone floor. The vertical shaft stabbed deep into the bowels of the mountain. The wide stone floor at the base was rimmed with shattered yellowed bones. A horizontal shaft ran off from one side of the pit. They followed the ancient escape route down a gradually declining tunnel. Emerging into sunlight a few moments later, they found themselves on a hollowed, level plateau, rimmed on nearly all sides by mountains. Only a narrow path appeared to lead down to the valley below. But it was not the path that had carried Adolf Kluge to safety. Remo's jaw clenched in helpless rage as his gaze settled on the well-tended and empty helipad that had been constructed on the plateau.
Oh, crap, there he goes.
He didn't even turn around as Heidi Stolp burst from the mouth of the long tunnel.
Where have you been?
Hiding. There was a soldier in the house you threw me into. I barely escaped with my life.
You're not the only one.
Heidi looked up at the blue sky. Wordlessly, Remo wheeled back around to the tunnel's circular black mouth. The bombs had been placed midway up the length of the tunnel. Their force had ripped apart the long rock cavern. The tunnel had collapsed, sealing them outside the quickest route back to the Four village. A thick cloud of dust grew over the elevated rock face on which they all stood.
Perfect.
It would take forever to climb back up the side of the cliff. The path was out of the question. The valley circled too far around the broad bases of several converging mountains. The route could take days. There was also the matter of Heidi. Remo looked dully at her. She looked first to the path, then to the rocky cliff face. Chun had turned away in disgust. He was already scaling the mountain face up toward the flat rear wall of the huge temple.
Could you...
Sheepishly, she pointed up toward Chun. Remo considered leaving her there, but his conscience got the better of him.
Let's go.
With Heidi over his shoulders, Remo stepped over to the sheer rock face. Trailing the master of Shinanju, he began the tedious climb back up to the top of the mountain. When Keijo Suk had accepted the money with a promise of more, he didn't know it was all the man had left in the world. He immediately deposited the large sum of cash in one of Berlin's many impressive Western banks. If Suk had so chosen, he could have left it at that. The man who had given him the money had a desperate, hunted look about him. His clothes were disheveled, his hair unkempt. It looked as if he hadn't slept in days. Dark semicircles rimmed his watery blue eyes. If Suk had kept the cash without performing the requested service, he doubted the man would be able to do much to stop him. But the man had surprised him.
You will not be able to take so much with you back to your country.
Sook only nodded.
You will likely leave it here.
Again, Sook silently agreed.
If you attempt to keep some money without supplying me with that for which I have retained you, I will turn you over to the authorities of your country. I am certain they will want to know how you came to have so much in an illegal bank account.
The look in the man's sleepless eyes convinced Sook that he was telling the truth. Sook decided to abandon his plan to cheat the man of his money. Besides, he had been assured that there was much more to be had if he performed but one small service. When Sook returned for the balance, he wouldn't leave the West again. He would live like a king for the rest of his life. But there was still the matter of the duty he had been hired to perform. His flight from Berlin had connected with another in Moscow. The plane he took from Russia had carried him across the remainder of Europe and on into Asia. When he had finally landed in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Keijo Sook was exhausted. But Sook had no time to rest. In Berlin, he was the official representative of North Korea's Culture and Art Ministry, allegedly sent to promote positive global understanding with the German people. Keijo Sook had in truth been sent to the West in order to form ties with the former communists of the former East Germany, who were vying for positions of power in the new United Germany. As a member of his nation's elite, Sook was allowed the privilege of owning a fine Western automobile. His Ford Taurus was waiting for him at the airport in Pyongyang. When he drove out into the streets of the North Korean capital, Sook didn't head for his small apartment. He instead turned north, driving out of the city into the featureless flat expanse that was the Korean countryside. The official People's Highway was dotted with few cars, fewer still as he drove farther northwest. The traffic he met was largely people on foot or on bicycles. Eventually, the pedestrian traffic ended completely. He found himself on a long, multi-lane stretch of barren highway that appeared to go nowhere. But Keijo Sook knew better than that. He knew precisely where this long road ended. He arrived at the rocky shores of the Korean West Coast a little after sundown. The highway simply stopped dead, and a small footpath that seemed as old as the stars in the dark black canvas of the night sky angled down off the road. At the other end of the path, Sook spied bright square patches of yellow, the lights of a lonely fishing village. Leaving his car on the highway, Sook skirted the edge of the village. He had no strong desire to draw unnecessary attention to himself. A massive garbage heap overflowed onto the ground beyond the highway at the rear of the nearest houses. Though it was cold, rats cavorted freely through the piles of ordure.
Oh!
Sook had to pull the tails of his dress shirt up around his mouth and nose in order to ward off the stench. The smell was so overpowering, his eyes watered. Unlike the rest of the population of North Korea, the people of this village ate well. The evidence was everywhere he stepped. Sook continued past the massive dump. The village was positioned on the shore of West Korean Bay. The only article appropriate for the weather was Sook's thick Western winter coat. It did him no good, however. The backs of the houses were plain wood with no windows. Sook crept past the homes, careful not to alert the occupants. The village ended in a small rise that led up to a solitary house. This dwelling was far more ornate than the rest. Parts of it seemed to have been constructed at vastly different periods of history. There was evidence of early Roman influence in the foundation, along with the practicality of ancient Greece, the frippery of the Renaissance, as well as that of Victorian architecture. To Sook, the home was a garish mishmash of styles. Checking first to see that he wasn't being followed, he made his anxious way up the path to the big, ugly house. The front door had been left unlocked. Sook was relieved to be able to shut out the cold wind. There was a light switch next to the door, but he dared not use it. Instead, he pulled a powerful flashlight from the pocket of his heavy down jacket. As he shone the light around the interior of the first room, Keijo Sook's jaw nearly hit the floor. Every spot his flashlight illuminated was filled with gold and jewels. It was more than a king's ransom, more than that of 10 kings. In fact, Enough treasure was crammed into this one room alone to ransom every ruler in the history of mankind. Sook had developed a powerful love for material wealth since assuming his post in Berlin. That was his reason for being here. It was difficult for him to break the initial numbing trance this fabulous store of wealth had put him under. After a few moments of slack-jawed gawking, Sook managed to pull himself together. He had a job to do. Stepping around the room, he walked towards the bags of jewels near the golden statues and the gem-encrusted chests of heaping ingots. The lights in the village had winked out one by one. All had gone to bed for the night, never noticing the strange flashes of light that came from the house on the hill. Unsuccessful in his search, Sook stood over the spilled jewels. He then shined his light into some sort of library and walked in. There were huge, leather-bound books, as well as a number of rolled parchment scrolls. The books were lined up on shelves, while the scrolls were squirreled away in an ornate mahogany wall unit divided into tiny cubbyholes. The object rested on a separate wall unit along the narrow, distant wall. Sook recognized it immediately. It was exactly as the man in Germany had described it. Sook had to step over a pair of large stone tablets that sat in the center of the floor. He pulled the object of his quest down from the shelf. Unbeknownst to him, Sook left a trail of freshly disturbed dust in his wake. He picked his way back out into the outer room. Across the room, flushed with triumph, Keijo Sook had given in to the urge to grab a handful of gold coins from an urn near the door. Like mints in a fancy restaurant, they sat there waiting to be taken. In the weak Asian moonlight, the three coins Sook had dropped glowed dully on the living room floor of the master of Shinanju. The corridors of Falcroft Sanitarium were cloaked in chilly semi-darkness as Remo Williams roamed up from the basement rooms in which he and Chun had been staying since arriving back in the United States. He pressed the elevator button. They had searched for Adolf Kluge in South America after he'd escaped. However, the trail had been cold. Heidi had left for parts unknown. The master of Shinanju had eventually hunkered down in their hotel in Uruguay, refusing to involve himself in yet another wild goose chase. Smith had no luck finding the fugitive head of four with the Cure computers. Eventually, he had admitted defeat. With great reluctance, Harold Smith had ordered Remo and Chun home. 10 days had passed since Remo had lost the elusive head of four in the mountains of Argentina. 10 days of inactivity. 10 days that Adolf Kluge would have used to burrow himself further and further away from the prying eyes of the world. When he had returned to the top of the mountain, Remo found a computer area in one of the old temple rooms. Someone had hastily sifted through everything and boxed up and carted off whatever was deemed necessary. Everything else had been left. The computers had been virtually smashed to pieces, their hard drives destroyed. They had been damaged, but apparently not enough. Smith had been able to access a fraction of what was left on one of the hard drives. From this, the Cure director had been able to reconstruct the entire structure of Forrest's finances. Remo had never seen his employer appear quite as shocked as when Smith had successfully broken into the Four encoding system, uncovering the vast holdings of the neo-Nazi organization. Smith had immediately set to work cutting the purse strings to Four. Some corporations he had sold off, others he had forced into bankruptcy. It took 5 whole days of work, but Smith had finally finished that afternoon. Wherever Kluge was hidden, he would not be able to access any Four funds. Once the finances were out of the way, Smith was able to finally devote full attention to locating the head of Four. So far, Smith had had no luck, and without a trail to follow, Remo was helpless to do anything. Remo wandered onto the floor of Fulcroft's administrative wing. Smith's outer office was empty. Mrs. Mikulka had gone home hours before. Remo walked through the secretary's drab little work area. Smith glanced up from his computer when Remo entered his equally drab office.
Nothing yet.
He looked back down at the computer screen set into his desktop. Smith's weary eyes scanned back and forth along thin lines of text. The dull amber glow of the computer screen cast a demonic glow across the Cure director's pale, haggard features. The master of Shinanju sat cross-legged on the threadbare rug before Smith's desk. Crossing the room, Remo sank down into a lotus position before him.
Did you sleep well?
Not a wink.
Sleeplessness does not a great assassin make.
Did you write that little aphorism for the next official assassin's newsletter?
Is there such a publication?
No.
I did not think there was, for no one contacted me. I sincerely hope that when there is, I will be the cover story of its premier issue.
Speaking of grand delusions, any luck with either of your statue ideas?
Lamentably, no. Emperor Smith has been far too busy with his current project. He has offered to take the matter under advisement.
I'll put in a good word for you.
It was Falcroft's outside line. Most likely sanitarium business. Looking at his watch, Smith frowned at the lateness of the hour.
Smith?
His features bunched into an unhappy mass as he attempted to discern what the speaker was saying. All at once, his eyes opened wide. He held the phone out to Chun.
I believe it is for you.
Chun scooped up the phone.
Chun, Master of Shinanju.
Smith, who is it?
I do not know. I believe he was speaking rather frantically in Korean. He repeated Shinanju several times.
Korean?
Is it possible it's someone from Chun's village?
I don't know.
Remo watched Chun carefully. The master of Shinanju's expression was unreadable. He tried to listen, but Chun had pressed the receiver tightly against his shell-like ear. It was impossible to eavesdrop.
Remo, I'm not comfortable with the prospect that someone from Shinanju might have this number. There are security considerations.
Remo and Smith both wore wary expressions as they looked over at the elderly Korean.
Oh, the dastards!
What is it?
Thieves! Scoundrels! Oh, the perfidy! We must be off at once.
Off? Off where?
To Korea, of course. That this could happen after lo these many years. What is this world the gods have thrust down around one as trusting as I?
Chun, I don't know what that was all about, but I am not going to Korea.
Chun wheeled. An accusing nail stabbed the air between them.
Betrayal? From my own son?
How can I betray you? Damn it, I don't even know what the hell you're upset about.
The treasure! The vast stores of priceless tribute to generations of greatness that is the House of Shinanju have been swept from the floors of my home like driftwood in a ferocious monsoon. Oh, I have been robbed, Remo.
Is that all?
How dare you be calm? The man you call father has been grossly violated. Thieves have pillaged my most prized possessions.
Well, that's too bad. Really? It's just that I thought there was something really wrong.
Really? Really?
Please, Master Chong.
Stay out of this, White.
Look, the treasure was stolen before. We got it back then, and I'm sure we'll get it back now. We can go to Shinanju as soon as we've cleared up this four business.
No! It must be now. Every day we dally allows the trail to grow even colder.
If I may interject...
I said mind your own business.
I only wanted to say that I've had little luck finding this Kluge. And frankly, your presence here is drawing undue attention.
You see, the wisdom of a true emperor, even Smith wishes us to go.
If something comes up, I will contact you in Shinanju. You still have a phone, correct?
The only one in the village.
Then it is settled.
Inwardly, Smith was greatly relieved. He wasn't comfortable when Remo and Chun stayed at Falcroft for extended periods of time.
Don't I get a say in this?
No.
Fine. We'll go to Shinanju.
Whirling, Chun raised a defiant hand as he marched over to the door.
And woe to he who would pilfer the treasure of the most awesome house of assassins in the history of creation!
Yada, yada, yada.
Hands in his pockets, Remo followed Chun reluctantly from the office.